Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome to episode 106, which is a special episode in which we reflect on how to build interdisciplinary spaces and dialogues across disciplines for the study of organizations. We present a conversation with Woody Powell and Bob Gibbons, who since 2016 have been organizing the Summer Institute on Organizational Effectiveness at the Center for Advanced Study in Behavioral Sciences in Stanford, California. This interdisciplinary institute allows scholars across a wide range of fields, from economics and sociology to political science and management and many others, to learn from one another. To learn more about the institute, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
So welcome to the Talking About Organizations podcast. And this is Pedro.
This is Sam, and today we're talking to you from the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences in Stanford, California.
This special episode does not focus on a text, as we usually do, but is rather a reflection about the study of organizations across fields and disciplines.
We're sitting today with Woody Powell and Bob Gibbons, who since 2016 have been organizing a summer institute for junior faculty to learn, discuss, and exchange knowledge and perspectives on the study of organizations.
Woody Powell is the Jacques Family Professor of Education, and by courtesy also Sociology, Organizational Behavior, Management Science and Engineering, and Communication at Stanford University. He's also Faculty Co-Director of the Stanford Center on Philanthropy and Civil Society.
Bob Gibbons is Sloan Distinguished Professor of Management at MIT's Sloan School of Management and Professor in MIT's Department of Economics. He's part of the Sloan's program on innovation in markets and organizations and founding director of the Working Group in Organizational Economics at the National Bureau of Economic Research.
Welcome, Wood and Bob. We also would like to welcome the 2023 Summer Institute cohort and past alumni who are also joining us today. These are wonderful scholars from economics, sociology, management, political science, public policy, and media and culture studies, who share an interest and passion in the study of organizations. Welcome, everyone.
So, Bob, Woody, we want to start asking you. So we're currently sitting here at CASPS, and this is a place where the Summer Institute takes place. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of this place and mostly how you and Bob came up with the idea for the Summer Institute?
CASPS was created in 1954 by a group of scholars, a number of them important organization scholars, such as Herbert Simon and Robert Burton, to create a space for interdisciplinary, transdisciplinary conversation. It has evolved over the years. It was originally a freestanding research institute, and more recently, it became part of Stanford University. CASVAS is a place where reflection, community building, and seeing outside, beyond your silos, your disciplinary silos, is kind of a hallmark. And the Summer Institute seeks to be in a setting that helps foster that and is amenable to it.
Yeah, so we'd both been fellows here twice, and we each had run a summer institute, which back in the day was for 6 weeks. And so we had enormous affection and gratitude for the place and inspiration when we walked through the doors, and a little bit of a sense that you could start something different here. So we tried.
We did not imagine that it would last as long as it did. The initial thought happened at a table right outside this this room at lunch one day, and we thought we'd give it a shot for a year or two and see what happened.
So what made you, what are the kind of factors or issues or things that you noticed that made you think that something like this was necessary?
Oh, come on. You have a measured reply to that? It's this big.
Yeah. I think we had a mutual sense that work on organizations was not advancing in a way that we personally found exciting and rewarding. Okay? In my area, sociology, management studies, broadly, everyone seems to be going down little alleys. You know, the idea of getting published is you come up with a new concept or you find a micro theory, and it's not even a theory, it's a description, and you call it a theory. And that's the way like academic reproduction happens. And to me, that was quite bothersome. You know, and rather than alleys, I'd prefer boulevards. But more than boulevards, we need parks. We need places where different people, you know, come to walk their dog, come to hang out, do different things. So they come into contact with different ways of thinking. And so we thought we could use CASBIS to begin to imagine what such a park would look like, what such a space would look like.
Yeah. So I think a shared sense of troublesome levels of siloization. Stay in your discipline, stay in your methodology, stay in your domain, et cetera, et cetera. So not very much learning in that case. And then at least for me personally, a little bit of, I don't know, dilettantism, wanderlust, or pinched shoe feeling in the discipline of economics. And boy, not sure I see the tools here for thinking about organizations in a full-bodied way.
And maybe one thing that happened that lunch and became a little bit of a hook, and that's where you got the name Effectiveness, which was a kind of framing, marketing sort of name, was I think Bob brought up the idea of bright spots. And for him, you know, bright spots are places where organizations punch above their weight, where they're doing things, you know, exceedingly well, and why we have such a hard time learning from bright spots. And one reason we have such a hard time is people who study the police never talk to people who study schools. People who study schools never talk to people who study hospitals. People who study hospitals never talk to people involved with immigrant organizations. People who study immigrant organizations tend not to study multinational firms. No, that's wrong. You know, that's, I think, fundamentally, we felt methods could be, you know, mashed up, could be learned from. But successful activity in organizing ought to be something we get excited about and look to see if we can translate it or transpose it.
Yeah. So to emphasize, I agree with everything what he said, but to emphasize part of it, you know, I've always been a little jealous of my colleagues in development economics who wake up in the morning saying, our goal is to improve the world. Well, so if we could diffuse bright spots, our goal would be to improve the world. Let's go.
So you mentioned that you're both fellows here, right? And you talked about the state of the discipline and what you imagine could be ways to improve it. But I wonder if in your own personal work, right, is there also a sense that interdisciplinary conversations are valuable? Have you also felt that in your own work that was an inspiration in order to, you know, offer other people the opportunity to do that as well?
I'll give two examples from this room on papers that maybe a few of your readers know. So first time I was a fellow, I was working on a paper called Neither Market Nor Hierarchy. And you know, there were people around like Bob Cohane, political scientist, who said, well, do you know the literature on reciprocity between states? And we spent a long time, and playing a good bit of tennis was certainly helped that, thinking about reciprocity in terms of a couple of things. So with states, with nation states, you have this really interesting phenomena that you might have a trade war going on, but at the same time, you're a military ally, all right? And as he talked about that, I immediately thought, I was studying at the time the biopharmaceutical field and the emergence of biotech. I'm like, oh, that's like collaborating on a cancer drug, but competing on a cardiology drug. Mm-hmm. All these organizations are doing that. I'm going to steal from the international relations literature. So there's a whole discussion of reciprocity in that paper that came out of talking to Cohane. There's a book, The New Institutionalism and Organizational Analysis. The conference for that book was held in this room. So all the chapters were workshopped here. And it could have just been a collected book. We could have said full stop. Okay, but I actually cheated a bit and stayed around at the center. And the subsequent year, one of the fellows was Douglas North. And Doug North was going through this transition of his own work to, you know, think much more seriously about institutions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he came from a very different space than I did. He came out of a more of a transaction cost framework. I'm much more coming out of a like cognitive framework, but we sat and like argued at lunch every day, what the heck is an institution? So I had to get back to Paul, to Majo, and say, we need to write an introduction, like what is an institution, you know, and give the history of institutionalism. Paul's like, no way, that'll take us forever. This book won't get out. And I'm like, well, he might have been right. I've had other books fail because of the introduction never appeared. But in this case, we managed to get it, and then we shopped it. So I think North, Cohane, Shepsley, Garfinkel, I mean, I could go on, the number of people who read that introduction. And it was a, you know, a really fascinating effort that ended up, I think, being the centerpiece of the book. You know, that the introduction's been reprinted lots of times, and it made an edited volume seem whole as a consequence of that. Could never have done either of those two things without being at a place like Castle.
So back to the Summer Institute. Clearly, a lot of thought and preparation goes into each edition. How do you design each of them, right? So we wanted to know a little bit more about the selection of participants, the structuring of the sessions, the preparation of the program, of the syllabus in particular, and all the readings, the invitation of the guests, right? So what is your process in order to do all of that?
So the most important thing is to find people like you two. After that, there's a limit to how much organizational economics or economic sociology or anything that either of us could plausibly say in week one, you ought to or want to hear. So as you say, there's a role for guest chefs both to expand what you all hear and talk about and honestly to keep Woody and me fresh. So that's work because those need to be different people every time, especially for the second function. And then not everybody immediately understands what we're trying to get done here. So there's some effort to explain that and kind of self-selection to see who's interested in other pieces.
Yeah, so, you know, Bob can cover the terrain of organizational economics quite easily. I could do the terrain of organizational sociology, but you know, the whole idea was to get people in other fields talking to one another. So we always want a component from political science, and whether it's people studying public sector organizations, whether it's people studying the bureaucracy in this country or other countries, whether it's people studying state building, that's important. Neither of us are ethnographers, so we thought we ought to have ethnography as part of this. And to our surprise, year one, and it's been true many of the years, the model builders from political economy and economics find the ethnography session the most interesting session. Now, the reverse hasn't been true, that the ethnographers find, you know, the why do you build a model? But Bob is working on that, and he gave phenomenal lectures last week about precisely that, that suddenly one of our ethnographers said, oh my God, we're doing the same thing. We are looking at a case, trying to abstract from the case, see what the elements of the case are, make the case really simple, say it in a few words, and does it apply to another place? Okay? And it's like, pop, you know, a little light goes on. You ask, you know, about the earlier stages, and that we didn't have a modus operandi when we began this. You know, we thought, let's advertise, let's send notes out, let's use the power of CASBUS to add, let's ask the professional associations to help. I think in year one, we maybe got 60-odd applications. Year two, it went up to 90. Year three went over 125. So I guess we figured we're doing something right.
So, you know, a lot of the Summer Institute is based on generating and having these interdisciplinary conversations, which can be very valuable. But, you know, there's also always the risk of you might just create confusion or people might just talk past each other. But from the conversations that we've been having here, you seem to have developed a method for generating productive interdisciplinary exchanges, at least an implicit method. So can you tell us a little bit about this method? How have you come to develop it? What have you learned throughout the years that then you then add?
So first of all, I think the risks are worse than you described. I think it's possible to cause people to feel hurt or mad or various other things. So setting some kind of tone from the very beginning that works against that is important. You know, confusion would be bad enough, but the downside is lower. there's then the difference between turning a room versus inducing self-censoring, and the latter is not so good. So, you know, there's still more work to do. Fortunately, maybe we each get bored with our own discipline and so on. And so it's pretty easy to ask questions of the other people who are in the room or ask questions of each other that model some of what we're trying to make happen.
Two things. One I'll say, and then the other I'm going to kick over to Bob because he was the one who started formalizing it. Early on, we saw a need and then I think leaned in and developed it much more explicitly of how do you build a community that's willing to share and ask open-ended questions for 2 weeks. And so, you know, we have a lot of things we do in the Sunday night before it starts and then on Monday. So there's a bunch of design work that goes in to attempt to build a community. You know, it's an imagined community. It may work for some. It may not work for everyone. But the hope is that creates a relatively safe environment where people feel comfortable asking naive questions. And so that's very important. And then we came up with this kind of funny, silly, maybe brilliant, way of thinking about characterizing how people should react to material. Okay. And we've even added to that today. So why don't you take it over, Bob, and do that part?
So I think you had Picasso at the beginning about stealing. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's liberating or clarifying, putting words on it. It's okay. We encourage, right? And we give some examples, as we did last week. But it wasn't enough. I think it's kind of rare to just pick something up exactly as it was in its home domain, move it over, even if you cite it like mad, and plug it in. So as we started looking, I think this Ezra Pound one about the idea that the poem inspires in the head of a reader is more important, or at least more important for our current purposes than what the author did or didn't mean. Mm-hmm. So there's some kind of idea of transposition rather than outright unaltered stealing there. And then that turned out not to be enough because, you know, you'd see people during discussions and they'd be squirming in their chair or something like that. And so somehow we got to Oyster, and by kind of A, we could see the medical center, and B, logical extension. We said, oh, maybe there's something beyond the Oyster, turning the irritant into a pearl. So we got to emergency room or ER. Right now we have 5, which maybe we need a better name, but I'm calling it Botanical Garden for all the unique flowers that bloom there. And there's no presumption that you should want to take one home or could, and no presumption that were one to plant itself in your garden that you wouldn't rip it up as though it were a weed. But, you know, pass by, right? Check yourself out of the ER, perhaps. I don't know. So putting that slightly differently, and I don't know that we have any good examples of this yet, but I could imagine that down the road we'll work out situations where it's really important to have a discussion that's putting somebody in the ER. Suppose somebody feels like they're headed for the emergency room. Having them simply declare, oh, this is a hothouse flower I can ignore, might be another instance of self-censoring. Mm-hmm. Okay, so if there's really an emergency room discussion to be had, we better have it. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there wasn't sort of an off-ramp in the original 4 categories, and so that's what the 5th one does, and sometimes maybe that's the right thing.
The idea behind those is, as people encounter and experience ideas that are distant, you know, from their comfortable domains, they may react to that in very different ways. And so we wanted to give a classification system for your reactions. I think part of the Oyster came from in the first year, one of the participants said, well, there's work that irritates me. You know, it's sort of, I admire it because it irritates me. But, you know, the fact that it sticks there and maybe I have to come to grips with it and think about it is really important. And so that was, we wanted to encourage. But by doing that, you make what's strange comfortable, okay? And that's the idea behind that. Like suddenly people are reading things far from their field, which their initial reaction might, why do I have to read this stuff? Why do I have to talk about it? and you then see, you know, some advantage of, I really could steal that. We've seen some examples of stealing. I could transpose that. I could move that. So that happens. And then just this past week, we had this exercise with Jean Tirole, who talked about he wanted to figure out how to advance his thinking on engineering commonality. And I think in our initial discussions of that, some people maybe didn't quite have an ICU moment, but they were like, what is engineering and what is commonality? And then we sort of moved it more into the oyster realm to where folks like, all right, I have to take this seriously and think about it. And then the next morning, people had to come in and say, well, I have a bunch of ideas I want to share with you. And, you know, Tirole being who he is, he sat there and listened and then talked about ways where he might be able to incorporate those ideas and other ways where it wouldn't be very easy for him to incorporate those ideas. And that was the kind of conversation you'd love to see. And both of us wish that was routine in the academy, and sadly, it's not.
So I think you said, Woody, something like make the unfamiliar comfortable or make an irritant comfortable or something like that. Next door to that, and I think important to hold up, I think we also mean to be making discomfort legitimate.
I would go even a step further, although I don't know if this may be more you and me than anyone else, making the comfortable an irritant. You know,
both. Okay, you just won the Jim March Award.
I mean, both of us sort of have this experience when we're around too much people who talk like us, we want to leave the club and go join another club. And then we hang out in that club for a while and decide, uh-oh, I got to go back. That's definitely making the comfortable uncomfortable is part of what I hope we do some of.
So we are recording this at the end of this year's edition of the Summer Institute. So we wanted to know a little bit more about, beyond these 2 weeks, you know, what are your midterm or long-term expectations, right? Your ideas and your attempts and work to foster community within, but also across cohorts. And how do you hope maybe to do this over time, and maybe some things that you have learned about doing that, given geographical and disciplinary distance?
So expectations seems like a big word. Maybe hopes, can we dial it back a little bit? And at least I have hopes at the individual level. If somebody's happy that they were here, and that's the end of it, but they go home and they think a little differently, and they act a little differently, and they hear a little differently, that's fine. And, you know, already there may be people who experience less of a treatment effect than that, right? who regret coming or something like that. But then as you sort of work through the distribution, yeah, I think people who engage in more outreach of various kinds once they go home, still at the individual level, then maybe people become friends within cohorts or across and contact each other for help and support and things like that, whether by email or the phone or Zoom or something like that. And then, as you say, we got to a point where after the first two cohorts in 2016 and 17, we started asking ourselves, wow, wouldn't these people like to meet each other? Mm. And so I guess everything I said before started at the individual level and then was intended to be at the within cohort level. But as you say, there's now the across cohort level. And sometimes those have been some of the most interesting discussions because people really have been excited to meet each other. And you get a little more breadth and a lot more depth in the room. So Woody was talking about all the constraints. You know, we're interested in representing lots of disciplines, lots of methodologies, lots of organizational domains, including domains that are organized but not in a formal organization. And so with 15 or 16 people, you just run out of room really fast. And so a big advantage of integrating across cohorts in a convocation, as we call them, is you loosen those constraints a lot. And then all of the aforementioned individual and cohort specific benefits seem like they also come back into play at a bigger scale.
Yeah, the cross-cohort work is what's, I think, really fun for us to observe. You know, and someone just said today, I think it was Andrea, like, would you believe there are three women from Mexico, an ethnographer, a lawyer, an economist? You know, that the connections that can be formed there, I think, are really fascinating. They can be, you know, friendships in the same discipline. They can be friendships at the same university. They can be friendships in the same country. We'd love it to become more interest groups and see if interest groups evolve. We started conversations about that this year. You know, I'll put on my CASBIS hat, thinking in a more formal role for CASBIS. I think eight former summer scholars have become CASBIS fellows. And so that's been a nice pipeline for them. And so far, they've been especially good fellows, because they bring much more a spirit of cooperation to, you know, the group that's here. So that's been really cool too. But, you know, that's an area we're open for exploration. How to build this beyond this kind of special place is something we think a lot about, but don't have a cookbook of answers.
Well, and in addition to moving it beyond this special place, I talked about individuals going back and doing more outreach than they had previously. But last spring, we did something at the Cambridge Judge Business School that was very much intended to do sort of 50-50, you know, bring half the people from this group, different cohorts, and identify with help from insiders there, half the people at Judge or elsewhere on campus, and say, boy, you know, could you double the size real fast, sort of like identifying a group that had a similar mindset but hadn't been through the CASBIS experience.
In doing that, you know, we've always wondered, and we joke about this, is it the selection, that is, we pick really interesting people, or is it the treatment, or is it something indissoluble between it? At Cambridge, we saw the treatment matters. So that really stood out to us, that our folks were much more comfortable talking in interdisciplinary fashion and asking questions and making comments far from their home disciplines than the faculty there were. So is that a good thing or bad thing? We think it's a good thing.
I wonder also if you'd like to talk about your experience in trying to maintain the community over Zoom, right? Especially during the pandemic, and maybe the different things that you have tried and how that was structured.
Well, yeah, that came at an interesting time, I mean, for everyone. But we had decided not to create a new cohort for the summer of 2020. So we had a team of 8 people, several of whom are here, pulling together somewhere between sessions and baby interest groups, you know, talking about, okay, how are we going to spend, I think, a whole week together? And we expected lots of people to come, because lots of people already came for long weekends from far distances in April of 18 and April of 19. So the good news was we had content all of a sudden. We didn't have to say, oh dear, put our lectures on Zoom for a new cohort or something like that. So the audience was clear and the content was pretty clear. And people got up in the middle of the night to join this stuff from Singapore, Australia, Hong Kong, you know,
and stayed till 2 a.m. From Moscow or right. From St. Petersburg.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, yeah, yeah. So when people liked it, as with the early convocations, they said, you must be doing something right. We said, okay, we'll go try to do more. And that led to 2 or 3 2-hour chunks on Fridays on Zoom during the fall semester, and 2 or 3 more in the spring semester. And sometimes, for once, for kind of the early first times we started to do this, we'd have work in progress presented by a group member. But other times we'd have sort of 1 hour with a guest chef. So we had Marianne Bertrand from Chicago talking about stereotypes, which was fantastic. And we had our usual cross-disciplinary discussions and then an open conversation. So as I think lots of people eventually experienced, there was a silver lining to some of this Zoomness.
Yeah, not to be too trite, but a bug became a feature. It worked in different ways. And so during the Zoom Summer Institute, you know, that occurred in 2020, we had essentially a pop-up session on reimagining policing. Okay, so that just seemed an essential thing to do in the wake of the murder of George Floyd. And so we had people put together a session on heterogeneity of socialization in police departments and how do police departments vary in terms of how they're organized. I wouldn't say we moved in the needle at all on that, but it was a valuable discussion to have. And I think everyone came away thinking about the topology of policing. But then other things were more like community organized self-interest. One of the things that makes me happiest. So in our second year cohort, we had a scholar, Celine Reynolds, who was at a very early stage of working on how Title IX got transposed into sexual harassment law. And she kept working on it. And then during Zoom, she said, I have a draft of the paper. I'm getting ready to send it out. So, you know, I hate the term workshopped it, but, you know, essentially we had a discussion about it that I think she believes improved the paper greatly. And now this year's cohort read it as a, you know, an American Journal of Sociology article and deeply influenced by this process. So that to us, if you ask us, I think, like, what's enriching? To us, that's enriching too, you know, to see a piece take shape and evolve and then see the light of day and other people read it and find value in it.
So this concludes our questions. So everyone is invited. I see there's already a lineup. So please, Angie.
Hi, everyone. My name is Angie Bautista Chavez. I am an assistant professor at Arizona State University, and I am a part of the 2019 cohort.
So the Institute is called Organizations and Their Effectiveness. And over the years, I've seen how as a collective, we've nuanced how we think about organizations. And I think we've talked explicitly about organizations, organizing, organizational. And so I wanted to have a conversation with you or hear your reflections on the second part of the title, effectiveness. And I'll share that when I first applied to the Institute, as someone who studies the politics of immigration policy, I immediately had instincts about the term effectiveness. And I was curious about what kinds of frameworks, what kinds of discussions we would have around effectiveness. But as we've discussed this year, most of our intellectual labor and collective work has gone to the organization piece. So I wanted to invite you to join me in thinking through this. And I wanted to hear, in your respective fields, what is the current leading thinking on the intersection of organizations and effectiveness? Like, where are your fields right now? And from the discussions with our cohorts, what have you learned from us or from conversations here about that intersection? And can you brainstorm ways forward of how we as a collective can also move forward the conversation around effectiveness?
So as Woody said, I think that did start with the idea of bright spots. In fact, we had a conference in this room in October of 2015. When we sat out there and had lunch, that was in May of 2015. But having been here for 2014-15 for a fellowship year, not only were there lots of meetings during the year, but that led to reasons to come back. So for example, Dan Carpenter and I did a thing on regulation as organizations acting on organizations. And then that was lunch to lunch, like Wednesday lunch to Thursday lunch or something. And then Arnie Milstein and I did something on bright spots with some help from the Carnegie Institute for the Advancement of Teaching. And the domain was mostly medicine and a little bit schools. And questions like, why don't the laggards catch up, surfaced there. So I think pretty simply and pretty clearly, those kinds of persistent performance differences among seemingly similar enterprises are the leading inspiration for both theory and measurement in organizational economics over the last decade. It's obvious. And the theory's hard, the measurement's hard. Can you really be sure you're comparing Gravenstein apples to Gravenstein apples? But I think everybody has experienced situations where they look around, some group of interested parties, everyone looks at each other, and they say, isn't this going less well than it could? That's a failure of effectiveness. What do we do about it?
I think I have a rather different take, as I should, given my intellectual background. But there's a comment, if I might use the world of sports. So this is an old comment in football, American football, global football. It won't mean much to people in terms of the teams, but there was a famous coach, Don Shula of the Miami Dolphins, and one of his competing coaches, Bum Phillips of Houston, in a very Southern accent, said, "Shula can take his'n and beat your'n, but what's really infuriating is he can take your'n and beat his'n." And what he meant there was like the coach could take the other team and beat his team with it. And we've all seen examples like that. An organization works a particular way, and then a new regime comes in. It's the same cast of characters, and yet it suddenly works. You know, right across the bay here is the Fremont plant that General Motors ran for decades, and Toyota came in. It became the new United Manufacturing and Motor Company. And suddenly it went from worst performing plant by GM to second best performing out of 34 plants. And like, was there some kind of secret sauce? Now it's a Tesla plant, and you know, there are charges of racism, sexism, all kinds of problems with it. So, you know, same plant for GM and Toyota, there were same workers. In that sense, I want to ask, like, effectiveness for whom, to whom, for what? Those seem like really important questions to think through. Yesterday, we had an interesting discussion with Sangjuta Paul about competition policy, but I thought one of the interesting things in the room was, no, most competition policy is designed to think about firms and consumers. How would that change if you thought about workers? How would you think about that in terms of its effects on the larger society? Now, in sociology, I think when people think about effectiveness, they think about two things. One is what I would call fidelity. By fidelity, I mean fidelity to a mission, like to a purpose. Fidelity to employees, perhaps, would be another way of thinking about that. And they talk about authenticity. And, you know, the authenticity could be to a craft, to a moral authenticity that's very close to purpose, or to type. You know, this does say, I often remind people, Center for Advanced Study. Okay, so as we do things here, we ought to be doing things that advance rather than just run it like another bureaucracy or another department. It ought to look different. You know, that's challenging for people. And so that kind of sense of effectiveness, I think, is important to keep in mind.
Let me be a little bit more concrete, if I could, about going back to persistent performance differences and where it's gone. I have two things very much in mind, but maybe it's important to name them. So one is the huge agenda on starting to measure management practices, which is now taken off in organizational economics. And the other is, on the theory side, if we were talking about interventions that were easy to copy, it's really unclear why the laggards don't catch up. And so that puts an emphasis on the informal side of organizations or the culture and things like that. And so I think it's been an interesting moment where data has driven a change in emphasis on the theory side.
My name is Christoph Brandner. I am an assistant professor of social innovation at UM Lyon Business School in France. I've had the pleasure of coming to CASPIS since 2016, and I noted that you two have been enjoying each other speak since 2016, or I guess 2015, in fact. My question is the following. One of the ambitions of the Summer Institute has been to find a common vocabulary for organizational scholars in different fields, in sociology, political science, economics, management, communication, and beyond, to speak to each other, and to do so without equating similar or like words that actually don't have the same meaning. So power in economics is not the same thing as power in political science, so that might not be, you know, a good word to use in the same room without previously defining what it means. And then there are other words that just don't exist in some field yet, but that are hard to translate, like autocatalysis, or payoffs, or bureaucratic autonomy, or maybe something called mu, you know, that also makes it difficult to speak to each other. But then there are these words that we can maybe think of as boundary objects that maybe have a similar baseline understanding. But Bob, this morning you said, we were talking about coordination, and you said, you and I would take coordination in different directions. And that's, to me, an example of a word that actually has a similar baseline understanding, but it actually takes us into different directions. It maybe allows us to speak about things across disciplines. So my question was, what is your favorite boundary object or word or concept that has allowed the people in this room to speak to each other rather than past each other?
Well, I'll be a little boring to start us, and then you can make us more interesting, and then maybe I can whip back. But the one I love, not surprisingly, is transposition. I like it because it has a polysemic quality to it. And so one could transpose parts of a model, and a modeler can easily see transposition as having, you know, elements. Moving from, you know, an idea in political science, listening to Jenna Bednar or Dan Carpenter talk, it's not really stealing, just, you know, move into a different domain and can use in ways that they didn't intend, but it's helpful for me. So I'm constantly enjoying that process of taking something from a somewhat distant area and moving it. So I talked a teeny bit about it last week, but the current thing I'm fascinated with is assembly and, you know, ideas about gluing, like what can attach to what. It's like a kid's Lego, but it suddenly helps you think about what are the combinatorial possibilities of different organizational forms. So that's assembly has become my boundary object.
So I think you're right to worry about words that may not mean the same thing. And again, if I back up to at least one of my goals for this enterprise, it's that people go home enriched and find their experience from here and after they get home enriching. So to use that Ezra Pound possibility, it might be sufficient that you use a word, we talk about what it means to you, I kind of understand what it means to you, and I go home and do something different. So a lexicon, a translation, isn't my highest goal, and I kind of despair of achieving it fully. So there's that inspiration Ezra Pound aspect. And then that said, I love the phrase boundary object, which I may or may not understand the way you do. And I think of things like the ethnographies that we talk about in here as usefully rich settings where people can point in detail and say, I'm focused on that part, and this is how I would think about it. And in the end, it may not be amenable to an exchange of labels. It's the culture, it's the relational contract, something, something. Nor do we have to agree on what we see or agree on what the main mechanisms are. Again, back to Ezra Pound.
I think you certainly don't have in mind that people will hear you talk about relational contracts and then run around and see relational contracts everywhere. In that sense, we'd rather think of boundary objects as like a self-deforming mirror, those mirrors you see in at carnivals, in which you look in the mirror and you kind of see yourself, but you're not yourself. And so, well, I'm trying to think about relational contracts, but this isn't a contract. It's maybe even it's a muddy relationship. But this whole idea about commitment and coordination and how it's done outside of the formal world of contract becomes really fascinating.
So I do kind of want everybody to see visible hands everywhere they go. And once you get there, I kind of want them to see something like promises everywhere they go. And then, I kind of do want them to think about, well, there might be a credibility problem. There's almost certainly a clarity problem. So I'm not giving up on a certain amount of diffusion.
Right. But notice what you said, clarity, credibility. There's some wonderful features of thinking about it.
Hi, I'm Madeline Rauch. I'm assistant professor at Copenhagen Business School, currently visiting scholar at Stanford. I'm part of the 2023 cohort. So my question to you is, this Summer Institute is a very special place, and during the last 2 weeks, you have often stressed of asking good questions. What is a good question?
That's a good question. Oh, okay. So a good question is a gift, all right? It's a gift the person asking the question gives to a speaker. You know, I often use rural football. It's a Kevin De Bruyne pass down the field to an empty area of grass that the striker can run to. Okay, we've all been in rooms where people ask questions that suck the air out of the room. People ask questions that go on way too long. People ask questions, haven't you thought about my work? Or people ask questions of, have you ever thought about this? I know nothing about this, but this must be, you know, we don't want that. We almost don't allow it here, okay? And so the idea of a question should be, it starts a conversation. It's the beginning of an intellectual relationship. And you know, there have been years where we've had evening sessions or late afternoon sessions on how do you ask a good question? Because it's not something that this past September for the CASBIS class, we had an explicit session for an hour on, you know, and these are to more established and senior faculty on what does a good question look like? And I began with a YouTube video from medical schools, 5 minutes of horrific questions, and the room was in stitches. And so that opened up the possibility to have a discussion about, like, what is a generative question? And to get a generative question, there's a prior, you have to engage in generative listening. You have to want to understand, you know, what the person is trying to do and say. And then you want to ask the question that sort of maybe helps, nudges, directs. It's not to show you know more literature. It's not, you know, a question is not your job to show off. It's your job maybe to, you know, clarity, credibility, and, you know, start a relationship.
So I think both you and Woody, Madeline, had at least in part in mind something like a seminar setting or this Summer Institute setting. And as I heard Woody talking, I was trying to track how much of that answer, and I think the answer is a lot of that answer, would apply to something like what's a good research question? Mm-hmm. So the idea that you're trying to start a conversation, I think, is interesting to think about in that connection. So there are lots of things that we aspire to do here and probably should surface a little more and a little better, even if we can't sharply define even what the goal is, not to mention what our intervention is. But that's one of them, is what does a productive research question look like?
I'm Sarah James. I'm an assistant professor at Gonzaga University of Political Science, and I am also a member of the 2023 cohort. And I think most basically, I'd love some thoughts from you both on how to become an effective, maybe not to use that word, or just a good oyster. I think in particular what I mean by that is what are some concrete strategies or just things that you tend to do when an irritant gets introduced? And I'm also curious if your answer to that has changed over the course of your career.
Now, that's a good question. It's also a very hard question. So maybe one reason the two of us enjoy doing this and find it relatively easy to do with each other. I literally couldn't imagine doing this with anyone other than Bob. And we didn't know each other that well. We encountered each other. We talked to each other. But, you know, we weren't close friends when we first started this. But I think both of us have been in settings, interdisciplinary settings throughout our careers a lot. And strangely, perhaps, both of us have taken a lot of time to sit in and talk to, sit in courses and talk to people from other disciplines. And so I think I mentioned a little bit the first job at Yale, where I ended up spending more time talking to economists, Dick Nelson and Sid Winter, than anyone in my department of sociology at the senior level. And then people like Ed Lindblom and Bob Dahl in political science. I talked with them a lot. Tom Emerson at the law school. I even snuck in his class and took his class. So that was just super enjoyable. I learned so much more from doing that, okay? And all of that was trying to figure out an oyster, because it was all far and distant for me. And I'm thinking a lot about how in the world can I use this? And maybe one of the best examples I think I mentioned to you was, you know, reading Tom Schelling's Micro Motives and Macro Behavior. And that became an inspiration for Paul DiMaggio and me. And it's like the opening paragraph of our Iron Cage paper, this image that Schelling has of people driving west on the Massachusetts Turnpike into the sunset where the sun is overwhelming them, but seeing the cars coming the other way, driving in the darkness with their lights on, and they flash their lights on. And, you know, you could call that a tipping phenomena. I started thinking about it with some early ideas about isomorphism. Paul and I got started. So that was sort of like, I don't know how that was an irritant, but it was certainly something that, like, could I build and grow into something? And so if you start a career doing that, you get more comfortable doing that. And then, you know, I'll let you say more about this, but in different ways, both of us have been deeply affected and touched by the late James March. You know, Jim was a mentor, a supporter in lots of different ways. And he is the most unusual of irritants because Jim literally would find value in the ideas of everyone. a lot of people would perceive it as he's just so nice to everyone. That's not entirely true. But, Jim was Jim, but he would search out and find something that he found interesting in each person. And then, you know, that was the basis of a conversation. And watching him do that and learning from that was, that's how to be a good oyster in my book.
So, I'm going to end up saying Jim was nicer than I am. But so it comes to a similar place, though. So, okay, Sarah, good question. How do you be an oyster? Well, first of all, don't get it wrong, right? If you need a trip to the ER, don't misconstrue this as an oyster moment. On the other hand, as I tried to say before, legitimizing the potentially lengthy discomfort of the oyster stage, I think, is important as well, right? So this is fine. Let's see where this goes. You know, assuming it's not on the critical path and it has to be resolved tomorrow or yesterday and so on. So maybe it's an advantage. Economics hasn't had much to say about organizations for a very long time. So if you seek to start thinking that way, then you're almost forced to go elsewhere to get inspirations and ideas. And so I understand Woody to be saying Jim was being gracious and finding something and saying, you know, thank you. That was an interesting idea. I'm much less gracious. I just find something and I'm happy if I find something. And we've talked here about different ways that people process, maybe not discomfort, maybe not confusion, just interpretation, things like that. And some people say, oh, I need to go write. And other people say, oh, I need to go talk. And it won't shock you to hear from me, oh, I need to go try to write down a model. And so, you know, that's a very productive process for me. Even if I don't go, and it happened a bunch, you know, questions from Sam last week. And she says, shouldn't that happen in the model? And I'm like, no, not in this model, but I see where you're going. And I know now where to crack open the model so that we could start exploring that. I don't know how to do it. I don't know what it'll produce, but thank you. That's a gift, right? So I think that fits in Woody's category of a good question.
Hi, Martin Williams from the University of Oxford. I'm curious to hear, in creating the Summer Institute and in building this community, what are some things that you thought were going to be difficult that have turned out to not be so difficult, and also some things that you didn't anticipate were going to be difficult that have turned out to be very difficult?
Mm-hmm. I didn't know if we'd have applicants, and the thing just shot through the roof, and then you're crying because you could make three good classes, right? I didn't know if people would talk to each other. And now we're in not quite the witchcraft and superstitious learning business, but it worked so well the first year. And so we said, boy, it would be really good if we could make that happen again. And a little bit like Intel copy exactly in building a new semiconductor fab, right? We did some copy exactly as well as we could. So yeah, a number of things. Some that we worried about in advance and some that we were too dumb to worry about in advance worked out really well. I think nothing has really felt that difficult. So would I like more funders to be beating down our door? Yes. But when you find the right ones and you pitch it in a, I don't mean a person specific way. I mean, just in the way we described at the beginning of this, they go, oh yeah, I see there's a need here, right? Well, so there we go. I think you mentioned what this discussion with Julia DiBenigno about, I was trying to make sure if I ever got invited to go on an ethnography, I wouldn't mess it up. Now, keep in mind, it wasn't lunch, it was dinner. So that's 4 days of exposure to me that the non-economists in the room had had. And, you know, maybe I was such an ogre that it caused some of them to go, oh, Bob, you mean to wreck an ethnography, don't you? And I'm like, no, the opposite. You know, there's a little bit of field fixed effect, but I think the interpersonal dynamics have never really spilled over. The field dynamics have never really spilled over. And so I think maybe it's being here, both in terms of how one feels when one first steps foot here, and then the bigger advantage that Woody and I have spent so much time here. And so we chill out and smile just driving up the last little part of the road. You take a breath and it works out. So it's been pretty good.
I don't think anything has been dramatically harder than we thought. You know, we had both run different summer institutes here many years ago. and those were 6 weeks long. And so in 6 weeks, you can do a lot of things. You have more time to build a community. You have more time to send people away to read and write. And so we had to compress it into two, in part because it's so damn expensive in Palo Alto that it's now more expensive to house someone for 2 weeks than it was for 6 weeks 15 years ago. So the compression became an issue. And the compression did get translated into the way people describe this as a boot camp. The 6 weeks were not boot camps. Okay. So now, you know, this is a strange, like, 2 week cross training exercise. You know, you have to listen, think, ask questions, go for a dish walk, you know, meet people. There's a lot of things going on. And there are times that we've gone home, just been so flat out exhausted, we collapse. And we're like, are we getting that old? Or is it what we're putting people through? And that's what it is. That's the way they feel. Oh my, that's not a good thing. But then two things happen. Like when we finish, we're always kind of enthralled with what has happened and excited. So we feel better when it's over than when we were about to start it. That we take to be a really good sign. And then, you know, Martin, people like yourself come back repeatedly to subject yourself to repeated treatments. Either we pick really strange people, which I guess I can't rule out, but I think that implies we're doing something right. It's funny because now there's another institute at CASVS this summer, and they did things differently from this, but they used the format that we did and transposed it. In fact, just literally, you know, this is like copy paste, you know, from Intel, you know, the schedule, the time, you know, then they had dinner here every night. There was no time to go away because they really were trying to build a community. So I think the model kind of worked. And now there are people at other places, former summer scholars like Aaron McDonald, trying to do a short version of this for 3 days. So I think the demand is out there for a different form of academic life. I won't say who said this, but someone earlier today said, you know, in his department, you're basically given instructions, you know, nose down, bum up, don't do anything else, you know, focus, focus, focus. And anything else, reading, talking, wandering to another department is considered wasting time. And so we spend a lot of the 2 weeks wasting time, you know. We spend our time talking about ideas that are distant rather than close. And I think that proves to be quite useful.
Serendipity somehow sometimes helps you. So as we talked about, there were something like 136 photographs taken in a couple of afternoons in the last 2 weeks. I was really tired this morning when I woke up early, you know, to deal with East Coast meetings before coming here. And I looked at all of them and I was almost jumping. I was so happy to see so many pictures of people so happy, 136 of them. Like, okay, this is totally worth it. So we should take pictures again.
Yeah.
Or you can just show me those.
No, no. we'll ask Christine to come back.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you both for your work and doing this. Talking about organizations is cool. I'm glad you do it. So, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Special thanks go to Woody Powell and Bob Gibbons for joining us in this episode. And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.